This is Pia from Pinery, and I'm here with a new episode, OMR Media. Here we run interviews with decision makers, executives, and smart minds from the media industry, like our today's guest, Ben Smith, editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed. Dear English speakers, please bear with me for a moment and a note to our German listeners. Hallo, liebe Heimatohren des OMR Media Podcasts. Das ist eine weitere englische Folge. Ihr dürft also die nächsten 40 Minuten meinem Denglisch zuhören. Enjoy. That was German. Talking to Ben is intense. He is one of these people who have a million thoughts on his head, and our conversation orchestrated some of his positions and views around standards, principles, and ethics in journalism, what his favorite digital media source for news and entertainment would be if BuzzFeed didn't exist. He talked about his favorite stories of this last year and what he expects for the coming year. And we even talked about our moms. So it was a very rich conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Have fun, and please let us know your feedback wherever you listen to this podcast. Have fun, viel Spaß. Ben, you're editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed. What's the best thing about your job?
Breaking huge stories, honestly, is the thing that I enjoy most. And I was reminded of that last week. On the same day, we broke the story about Trump offering Vladimir Putin a penthouse in his Trump Moscow, and a story about Sheryl Sandberg having a little more involvement in the George Soros stuff than previously known. And I had forgotten how much just pure fun it was to break huge stories. Or not forgotten, but it's always nice to be reminded.
What's the hardest thing about your job?
I think for me, the hardest thing is the kind of patience that longer term kind of structural planning and deals take. I mean, I enjoy a lot of that stuff. But
what kind of deals and what kind of planning?
I mean, I think, you know, we have just finished a season of a show on Netflix. We have a show on Twitter. We have a couple shows on Facebook. All of those moved very, very fast by the standards of the television industry, mm-hmm. but slowly by the standards of the internet. And I think we also have a show that aired on Oxygen, the American television network, that took years to develop. I think there's a different pace in other parts of the media industry that, you know, where there are huge audiences and lots of revenue and lots of great reasons to be there. But there's just sort of it's taken me a little while to get used to the pace of it.
Among these lengthy deals you've been working on in this past year, what was the biggest win for yourself?
You know, I really love our morning show on Twitter. It's called AM to DM. Everyone should watch it. It's on mid-afternoon.
What's so good about it?
In Britain. It's really authentically rooted in our newsroom. You know, it's our people, it's our reporters, it's our stories, it's our sort of voice and connection to the internet. And we are able to then bring on really great guests and break news, you know, whether it's major celebrities or presidential candidates, and break news out of those interviews. And so it's sort of a virtuous cycle. And it all happens on Twitter, which is the, you know, kind of the beating heart of news. It's the central vein of news, whether you like it or not. And so it's sort of piped directly into that conversation.
When you joined BuzzFeed, coming from Politico, I think 2012, right?
Yes, January 1st, 2012.
Well, that's exact. So do you think, was it clear to you that BuzzFeed will be a home for you where you can do these things of investigative journalism, breaking news stories, when I think back then BuzzFeed was still a brand that was much more associated with these GIF-loaded listicles?
Oh, yeah. No, BuzzFeed was born out of kind of web culture and experimentation and fun stuff that we now call entertainment. There wasn't even really a word for it then. Yeah, but they hired me to do news. I'm a news guy. So obviously, I wasn't ever as good at making lists of cats as some other people here, although I've tried my hand at it and I'm not terrible at it. But
what's your best list that you've created?
Yeah, I've done a few. I still think that ways that, you know, what was it? It was like 25 ways that you know that you're a geocacher. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you go geocaching. It's a sort of slightly obscure form of scavenger hunts that actually your German people are very into, even if you are not. So I'm sure some of the
one
listeners
of the many weird things
know what
into.
I'm talking about here. It's geocaching. I don't know. If I pronounce it with a German accent, you still won't recognize
geocaching.
It. It's anyway, get the coordinates of a hidden thing and you go find it, in my case with your kids. So I did an identity post for people who care about geocaching, which I was pretty proud of, with a colleague. But I'm basically a reporter and a news guy. And so, I mean, I think part of the fun part was forcing people who thought BuzzFeed was bizarre and ridiculous to go and read the news on us because we were breaking news about particularly, but I don't think we discussed getting it to this scale necessarily. You know, I think, you know, I came out of politics and saw the path as covering the 2012 presidential campaign very aggressively and breaking a lot of news there because it's, you know, it's sort of the central arena of American reporting, presidential politics. It's where, you know, it's so centralized that if you break news there, all your competitors notice, among other things. And so that was basically how we broke through. Although I should say I'd come from Politico, and before that had been at other startups, and I think did have a sense of, well, if you get this right, you can really make a difference.
Have the principles around your political news coverage changed in the course of the presidency of Trump?
I don't think the principles have changed. I think the situation has changed.
And what does it change in your daily work?
I think, in a way, the most abstract but most important part of it is that the president of the United States is the media consumer in chief, among other things, and elevates the media that he consumes. And it's true on any beat. If you cover media and the editors of important publications aren't reading you, it makes you less relevant, and you want to be doing stories that make them furious, and they call your boss, and they scream at you. And Trump, you know, consumes the media of the 1980s. He cares about the cover of Time magazine. He cares about television.
TV,
he cares about the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the New York Post, and that's it. And so Breitbart, much less BuzzFeed. Like, if you gave him a phone, he wouldn't be able to find it, or a computer. He wouldn't know how to turn it on. And so,
I mean, he is aware of you. He did call you.
Oh yeah, we've gotten his attention with reporting.
Yeah,
but we're never going to be. Not that you, and you never really want to be insiders in a White House. You never want to be captive to power. But I think we certainly are very comfortable with the status as outsiders here. And then Trump lies all the time, and so you. I mean, there's a convention of access journalism that when you talk to people, they tell you the truth, you know, as I am now, obviously. And if he violates that convention, what even is the point of talking to him is this difficult question.
But I was wondering if there were Trump-related changes to your ethical and journalism standards you're working on when I was reading your ethics guide. And there were many things about objectivity and transparency around it.
I don't think we use the word objectivity at all.
No, you don't. But you don't use the word. But I think you describe it in many other words. Like, for example,
yeah, we try. I mean, I think fairness is. I mean, I would say that we try really hard to be fair and to not let reporters' preconceptions shape what's written. And that's certainly still true. No, I actually don't think that stuff has changed at all.
Mm-hmm. Are there any learnings with covering Trump that you're actively sharing with your other global editions?
You know, the place that is most that's in a very similar moment is Brazil. Bolsonaro, you know, is in some ways much more extreme version of Trump. You can't let the president's words be the whole story. And in fact, you need to kind of limit the amount of energy you're putting into chasing what he says in favor of covering what he's doing.
Do you have a ratio set to what extent you're covering?
No.
What would be too much? What would be something that you would not?
Well, you know, you can publish 1,000 stories, and if nobody reads them, does that represent in the numerator, is that 1,000 or is that zero? Like, I don't know. So it's not so much about production as about people's time. I mean, as a reporter, the only resource you have is your time. And so it's really about trying to make sure that most of our reporters are not chasing the moment to moment.
You have this entertainment driven side of the BuzzFeed DNA, and it's maintained. And on the other side, you have you are more and more known for breaking stories, for investigative journalism, for the Russia investigations, etc. It's, I think, very clear how you measure the impact of your entertainment side of things, probably just reach. How do you measure your work on the investigative storytelling and journalism?
That's not true of the entertainment side. I think, you know, reach is the easiest thing to measure.
It is.
So we measure the hell out of it, and we measure all the things that you can measure well. But we've also always...
What else do you measure?
I think Jonah has also always seen a big part of BuzzFeed's DNA as about things that are harder to measure. You know, being a positive force in the culture, bringing people together, making people feel less alone. Those are all things that YouTube and, you know, fun quizzes and lists and things people share in social media. That's sort of the better side of social media, essentially, that I think you don't often hear about, but is real and is something that is in the DNA of BuzzFeed. And I think it's Yeah. So I think like they're...
How do you measure those?
You don't.
Things?
They're very hard to measure. You don't pretend to make up stupid metrics for them. But that is. But there's also a trap in only caring about things you can easily measure, that I think we're pretty aware of. And then on the, you know, all the way to sort of complicated investigative reporting, you know, we still care a lot about reach. Conversely, for that stuff, right? Like it does make a difference when a story goes huge and reaches millions of people.
Yeah, I think you said in an interview that breaking news has the biggest virality potential.
Yeah, it must have been a while ago.
Yes,
the internet keeps changing. And Leon, lots of people want to know what's happening in the world, but also there are much harder to measure aspects of it. Does it get a policy change? Does it change people's lives? Does it make people feel that you're out there fighting for them? And those are things you can try to measure with survey research, which we do, and brand studies and things like that. But ultimately, those are, you know, it's sort of my job to have a feel for that.
And what's your feeling?
I mean, my feeling right now is it's going well. Like, I think that we actually have managed, I think partly because we care a lot about traffic and reach, but are not obsessed with it and are realistic about journalism, that I think we have been able to, you know, hit really hard.
Last week, the millennial news site Mike announced a very ungraceful ending and sold for something like nothing, 5 million. Did their last-ditch sale ring a bell for you, or how did it echo within the BuzzFeed universe?
I mean, I think it's a really... I mean, it's obviously like a challenging moment broadly in digital media, and then it's a hard time to be small. You know, I think that these sort of small and medium-sized places that never quite found a lane for themselves and that were reliant on, you know, one or two pretty limited businesses are very, very vulnerable right now, and that's what you saw with Mike. I mean, I don't have a particularly sophisticated analysis anybody else doesn't have. I mean, it sucks. And there were lots of great people working there.
Unlike a tech product, a content-driven outlet lives by the brains who produce the content for it and by the audiences that consume the stories. And it's not a self-sustaining product that stands for itself and can be scaled in a similar way like a platform. I think that was very clear when Mike, where lots of venture millions have been put into, sells for something like 5 million. Is there any scenario that you could think of where the value of BuzzFeed shrinks to something like 5 million?
You know, I'm not a finance guy. Like, it is very easy to imagine all sorts of scenarios where the value of everything we're looking out at this window in Manhattan shrinks to zero, right?
What's the biggest value of BuzzFeed?
I mean, I think we're the most, you know, we're the leading news and entertainment publisher of a whole generation of media, and that we both speak to people of a generation, but also fundamentally care about the things that we care about that are different.
BuzzFeed doubled down on serious impact-driven journalism. Do you have studies if more people associate BuzzFeed with these, with the entertainment-ish side or with the investigative reporting side?
Oh, certainly the entertainment side. I mean, BuzzFeed is a huge entertainment brand that touches most millennials in America most months, and there's always been a bigger market for entertainment than for news. I mean, I think if you asked more, you know, in the 1950s, if you asked people if they cared about Marilyn Monroe or John F. Kennedy, more people cared. I mean, I think that entertainment is a bigger industry than news, and always will be. We have broadly people now see BuzzFeed as a place that you get news as well as entertainment. That's what our research shows. And then the other thing is that people who care a lot about news and take us seriously, and in some sense, if you're doing news, that's what you are most focused on.
What were changes in the audience that you could see when you built a new home for your news part of coverage?
A new homepage?
BuzzFeed. Yeah, exactly.
There weren't dramatic changes. We're not primarily driven by our homepage. I mean, I think over time, it was more a response to hearing from our audience that whereas maybe 5 years ago, there was something fun about a Facebook news feed that mixed serious and silly in a kind of an undistinguished way, that no one really wants that anymore. They want clearer labeling of what they're getting on the internet, partly because there's so much garbage now. And so I think that's what we were responding to, was a sense that our audience wanted more clarity around what was news, what was entertainment. And I think we've seen on election night, we had a lot of direct traffic to that BuzzFeed News homepage. And I hope your listeners will bookmark it. But asking people to bookmark homepages in the year 2018, like, it's pretty late in the day.
In terms of the donation or membership kind of model that you built in the last year launched
in the last month.
Yeah.
For real.
Wait, last month?
Yeah, we were experimenting with it at a very small scale and finally put it up for real 3 days ago as of this interview.
How much do you think is that, is people's willingness to pay for BuzzFeed or to donate for the stories or for the perks that they get when they become a paying member. How much do you think of this willingness of audiences is driven by the new side of BuzzFeed's brand?
Oh, it's a news. The subscription is entirely based in news.
Yeah,
and I think part of what we found is that people, when you say to people, "Would you like to subscribe for some additional benefits, but also to in order to help keep news free for everybody?"
No, but sorry, let me change the question. What do you think is the reason why people are paying for BuzzFeed?
Because they appreciate the journalism broadly, and then actually more narrowly because we do a specific story that matters to them. I don't think that many people subscribe for abstract reasons. I think and people other than people who actually work in the business don't necessarily like love journalism in the abstract. They love, you know, they love it when you do a story that matters.
BuzzFeed is a global brand. And you also have a team in Germany, I think 4 reporters, mm-hmm. right? And we have a good split of a German audience here. What are the biggest differences that you experience in the German market?
I mean, Germany is a complicated market for people like us because the internet, it's much less social. It's a more traditional internet use, a more traditional media
in
market.
What way?
You have it's dominated. There are no new players. It's dominated by huge legacy publications, websites, which are still figuring out how to be websites and not just places that throw up news articles from the paper, but Spiegel and Zeit and a handful of others.
But in the US,
dominate the internet as they dominate the news market broadly. Whereas in the US, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post are important players on the internet, but so are Huffington Post and Business Insider and BuzzFeed and a bunch of others. I think this may be changing a bit, but Germans use social media differently. There's less sharing on social media.
I think Germans don't like to show off themselves as much as American people do.
Yes.
So I think
it's
like
not just Americans,
more.
Though. It's people anyway. I mean, Germany is at the less than anyone else, I think, are more private in their use of social media.
But I mean, the kind of coverage that you do in Germany is around very serious topics and not necessarily just grown on
we do,
Facebook.
We do a lot of both in Germany. We do a lot of fun stuff in Germany. One thing we found actually is that some of our most popular posts are written by sometimes German, sometimes American, sometimes German writers working with American writers in English about the topic is weird stuff about Germany. Germans are really interested in what other people think about them.
Absolutely.
Maybe everyone is, but that has worked. But that's one.
What's the weirdest thing that you find with the Germans?
What's the weirdest thing that I find with Germans? The way they use the internet. It's very weird.
I don't understand it yet.
Their heavy dependence on legacy media for their information.
Right. So there is a dominance of legacy media, but still that does not shape the entire way how people use the internet.
No, not at all. But the sort of news ecosystem. There are no major startup newsrooms in Germany. I think Corrective is really cool and does interesting stuff, but is small and is itself a corrective, right? It's not trying to be anybody's main news source. Huh. It's an alternative.
You said that German journalists are so bureaucratic. How do you mean that?
Did I say? I think I said that off the record before we were talking. I can't believe you would burn me like that, Pia. I said I think German journalism, in my limited experience, and by the way, like I think we hired really great people, Daniel Drepper and others, who this doesn't really apply to at all.
Daniel Drepper somehow seems like a lookalike to you.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's why I hired him. But I think that there is a... And I, you know, I don't know German journalism that well, and you should tell me I'm totally wrong. But I think that there is a system of working your way up inside major institutions that is most people's career path, having gotten degrees in journalism, that is a bit more rigid than in a lot of other places, and feels, I guess, less just. And I guess the German journalists who I have met and worked with, many of whom I really like, are a little less eager to light things on fire just to see how they burn. Than, for instance, British journalists.
Mm.
It's a somewhat more careful, thorough, a lot of good things about it. But also less, I think a lot of good journalism is a little bit kind of anarchic. And I see less of that in German.
So I think
journalism.
there is...
But you should tell me, because you're the expert, and I've just gone and said dumb things.
I'm not the expert of the outside, the distant view on German journalism. But what I see is that there are some journalism... principles that from the outside don't make too much sense. Like, for example, the habit or the rule that you have to authorize any interview. And that means that after this interview, I would send you the audio file and you could delete and change everything that you like. And that's especially with written interviews with politicians.
Yeah, it's wild to me.
Yeah.
It's Although crazy. There's something kind of wonderful about it because I think like...
What is wonderful about it?
That after you publish it, I can't say you got me wrong. Because it is true in an interview like this, you, like I might have said something like what I just said about German journalism was a little stupid. And I might say, when it's published, I might say, oh, you know, I didn't really mean that. I kind of misspoke. And if I had signed off on the transcript, you'd say, like, what do you mean he misspoke? I showed him the transcript and he signed it. And I think there's some power to that, actually. I think it's kind of weird because you allow people to, sometimes these mistakes are very revealing. But I also think it's kind of interesting.
So I think when you take interviews with politicians, you can have an interview and then you send the written interview back to his press office and then anything can be changed. And that's not how it's supposed to be, I think.
Yeah.
Then there was something else. There's the rule, of course, I think that's global, that as a journalist, you try to keep a certain degree of objectivity to things. And recently there was the online editor-in-chief of Die Zeit, Jochen Wegner, and he said in a podcast interview what he voted for in last year's elections.
See, podcast interviews are where people always fuck up. It's a well-known fact.
Do you feel like fucking up here?
No. I'm very careful.
So, I think when you take this principle of transparency, I think it's even good when journalists disclose what they're voting for, because it would be illusionary that they can be fully objective to things. So, I
guess I disagree with that. I think that there, I don't know who has this illusion that people can be fully objective. I've never actually heard anyone say that. I only have heard people say that it's not true. But on the other hand,
so do you think that?
But on the other hand, let's take it out of politics. Let's say you're covering you're writing about sports. And there's a player who you think is like incredibly horrible looking and has bad breath. Would you tell them that? That'd be honest, obviously. But it would obviously also make it very difficult for you to get it, to cover them. And your responsibility, it's not to the people you cover. Your responsibility is to your audience. And so you should be...
And even the people you're covering, you have a certain degree of responsibility.
No, I think I disagree with that. I think your responsibility is to your audience.
Okay, I read a story on... Thrillist recently that was about a guy who made a listicle about the biggest the
burger places.
Most popular the best burger places, and he tested them all himself, like 300 burger places, and he selected family owned small burger place in Portland as the best burger in the world, and 2 weeks or so after the piece was published they shut down because they couldn't handle all these masses of people that were coming. And I think the article raised a very good question around responsibility about people or businesses that you cover, where he, the journalist, felt guilty of letting them shut down.
I think that's true. And I think like you can do harm that doesn't, and you make trade-offs that, and you I think it may be on the principle your audience wouldn't have really wanted to shut the place down. Down, but no, I think you're right. Yes, there are sort of responsibilities not to harm, not to gratuitously harm the people you cover, but I don't think that you owe people you're covering a responsibility, for instance, to be transparent about your intentions.
Have you ever harmed someone that you were writing about?
Yes, I think you know, nobody does it lightly, but I think the point of reporting is to tell stories that somebody didn't want told, and so there's usually some if you're doing that right, you are usually causing some kind of inconvenience for someone.
I think it's also almost unavoidable. I think it's like taking a picture of someone, and you typically don't like yourself on the picture and see things that you don't like to see, and it's just from one perspective. But
sometimes, but also maybe it's because you're doing really terrible things and are trying to hide them from
people.
Yes,
that is of course harmful and intentional.
So there's a great American saying that I want to get right, so I'm Googling it on my phone right now. You're right. News is what somebody doesn't want you to print. Everything else is advertising.
Who said that?
I can't remember. I don't know. Since you ask, I have found a website on the origins of it. I don't know. It's one of those things that people attribute to great journalists they like, but I'm not sure anybody ever. Yeah.
How much do you interfere with the business side in your, or the commercial side in your day-to-day work? Do you have a system of church and state in place at BuzzFeed, or how much
so
is it interconnected?
I think we have a very strong separation of church and state in the news division, but because I'm the editor, I sort of am the church's emissary to the state, or vice versa, whichever.
You're the Pope?
Or the state, not the Pope, the nuncio.
Ah, okay. How much of your editorial decision-making is interconnected with business decision-making?
None of the day-to-day editorial decision-making touches the business.
And on a high level?
We regularly, write tough things about advertisers and partners. And I think people who work at those companies, to their credit, understand that that's how news works. I think, on a higher level, sure, we're trying to think about what areas can be lucrative for us, what is a good business. AM to DM is a great business, and certainly that's part of why we're doing it.
So now the biggest revenue stream is programmatic or commerce?
I think our traditional advertising is still the largest revenue stream. It's just that we now have a lot of others as well.
How big will the membership or direct user revenue stream will become in the diversity of revenue
streams? I assume next year not very big. I think that's a very long-term play, and something that we both need to figure out, and that we need to sort of understand what our audience wants, and then just to grow gradually. I think if you look at The Guardian, for whom it's now this incredibly important source of revenue, that took, 7 or 8 years?
They hit the 1 million recently, 1 million members. What's your goal connected to membership?
I'm not sure I would tell you if I knew, but I don't have it on my fingertips.
Okay. Ben, I have a couple of rapid-fire questions. Which BuzzFeed story excited you most recently?
The Putin penthouse story.
Yes.
I literally jumped up in the air when I heard that we confirmed it.
What German BuzzFeed story excited you most recently?
Let's see. I guess I would say two. Juliana's coverage of intersex, both on the website and in the Netflix show, has been really amazing. It's something that, it's a somewhat different story and a different fight than we're having here, but so powerful and interesting. And she really was able to move that story forward. And then this is a little older, but Pascal Mueller's coverage of sexual assault in the strawberry fields of Spain, and how these, strawberries were being kind of given this stamp of approval in Germany, was a great story.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite podcast?
I listen to podcasts fairly often, but I'm not really a regular podcast listener. I've been listening to The Moth Story Hour a bit lately. I feel like I should have a better answer. There's a kids podcast called 6 Minutes. It's pretty good.
New York Times or Washington Post? Speaking of legacy.
Which do I prefer?
Yeah.
I grew up here in New York. I'm a Times guy.
Uh-huh.
My mom probably still wants me to work at the New York Times, but always did.
What are you telling her?
I interviewed for jobs there 3 times. All the interviews went like catastrophically wrong.
Why?
Specific reasons. When John Landman was the Metro editor, I sat down with him at a place in the Theater District, his favorite place, and knocked this giant American-sized Diet Coke right into his lap as I sat down. And then the next Metro editor, this is when I was a New York City reporter covering local stuff and going for jobs on that desk. The next one, she said, you do anything to work for the New York Times, right? And I was like, oh, absolutely, anything. And she said, how about moving to Albany? And I said, oh, no, not that, which is the sort of godforsaken state capital of New York. And then the third one, for more conventional reasons. I think I was already thinking that the internet was important, and the person who interviewed me didn't think the internet was so important.
Are you telling her that BuzzFeed is something like the New York Times?
No, she understands.
Okay. Is she reading your stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think like a lot of moms, I think she goes to my Twitter page and sees stuff there. I think Twitter
my
page.
My mom retweets everything.
Yeah, I think Twitter pages are great for moms, because it's like you can just see what your child is. I don't think they use Twitter like the rest of us use Twitter. In the feed with lots of voices, it's just like you just put up your kid's, twitter.com/Pia. And then you just go there and you can fave everything they do. It's kind of great.
I think it's for American moms, not for the typical German mom.
Perhaps.
They're usually not on Twitter.
But the typical person is not on Twitter.
She even has more followers than I do, I think.
Oh, that's brutal. That's like a real red flag.
She deserves it. She's a journalist.
All
right. From a user perspective, Facebook or Instagram?
Insta.
Instagram is even better for moms, I think.
Yeah. I was actually the last really real power user of Path.
Uh-huh.
Which I don't know if you remember, but it was a social network that was spun out of, that was a former Facebook engineer made, that was supposed to be like a kind of a private Facebook. It didn't push you to share too much. It was sort of perfect for sharing kids pictures of your kids with your family and images with your family. Sort of like a small an Insta that wasn't aimed so much at building a huge social network. Hmm. And as a result, it collapsed and was sold to a Malaysian company and finally went out of business this year. And so now I had to sort of move all that stuff to Instagram.
It should have pivoted to a family network just for kids and their moms.
It pivoted. Well, it was that really. It pivoted instead to being a messaging app for Malaysian teens. Ah. But then that didn't work out either.
What's the most interesting thing on the internet right now?
I mean, everything is on the internet. I suppose I'd have to say Donald Trump.
But there are dynamics happening on the internet. Movements.
I actually think that one of the really interesting things that is just vastly undercovered, but that Craig Silverman has written a lot about, is ad fraud. Uh-huh. I mean, it's just in my head because we had a story the other day, but you know, tens and hundreds of millions of dollars that in some sense ought to be going to publishers get stolen by criminals doing often quite clever things with apps that mimic the behavior of real users, and then they steal money from advertisers. And I know it's hard for sort of anybody to get all that upset and outraged that that toilet paper companies are losing 15% of their revenue to fraud. But I do find it kind of infuriating.
If BuzzFeed didn't exist, what would be your favorite independent digital media source for news and entertainment?
Let's see. That's a great question. What do I... You know, I'm an old blogger and I used to like read the blogs. Like I would type in the URLs of blogs and none of them really exist anymore. I think Pop-Up Magazine and California Sunday are doing a really nice job. Mm-hmm. I'm a subscriber. The only print publication I receive is Racket Magazine, this quite mm-hmm. excellent tennis quarterly.
Are you a tennis player?
Not a very good one.
The best thing about 2019?
I'm just going to answer narrowly, which is mm-hmm. that I am an old political reporter and I love covering national campaigns. And I think we have an opportunity to really be a very important place where the Democratic presidential campaign will play out between our coverage and AM to DM. And so I'm very much looking forward to being part of that. Beyond that, I don't think I want to promise you that 2019 is going to be a really great year for the world.
But probably interesting, news heavy.
I mean, yeah, here we are.
Here we are. Thank you, Ben.
Yeah, thank you. That was fun.
That was Ben. I hope you enjoyed this interview. If you did, please let us know. And if you didn't, please let us know too, wherever you're listening to this podcast. If you're still listening but don't know about my company Opinory yet, you should probably check us out. We drive on-site engagement that boosts loyalty and converts engaged users into anything from paid subscriptions to app downloads to newsletter signups. And the world's leading publishers and brands are working with Opinory to build a deeper connection with their readers. If you want to hear more, please send me an email to pia@opinary.com. That's pia@opinary.com. Us Germans like complex things. That also includes complex company names. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye and tschüss.